From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet Tom Fontana, executive producer of the new TV series Homicide, about cops who solve murders. Fontana used to be the producer and head writer for St. Elsewhere. Also today, the art of picking the timeless quotation. We talk with Justin Kaplan, editor of the 16th edition of Bartlett's Quotations. The new edition includes quotes from Ronald Reagan, Garrison Keillor, and Zippy the Pinhead. And book critic John Leonard reviews a new biography of the French intellectual Michel Foucault. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton met with French President François Mitterrand today. It was the two leaders' first face-to-face meeting. They discussed Bosnia, aid to Russia, and trade. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Clinton and Mitterrand were in agreement that some kind of coordinated international aid effort needed to be made soon to help bolster the reforms Boris Yeltsin is making in Russia. The leaders of the seven industrialized nations will meet in July, but Clinton said today that might be too late. He said that as soon as he comes back from his summit meeting with Yeltsin in Vancouver, he would mobilize members of the G7 to help. Clinton is trying to convince the American public to support increased U.S. aid to Russia at a time when domestic programs are being cut. And at the same time, he wants to convince international lending institutions to change their conservative approach to helping the newly independent republics. Mitterrand agreed with Clinton on the need to aid Russia. He and Clinton also agreed that no additional ground troops would be sent to Bosnia until a peace agreement was reached. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
The head of the FBI's office in New York told Congress today that the bombing at the World Trade Center was probably the work of a well-known terrorist group. James Fox said investigators believe the bombing that killed five people and injured more than 1,000 was committed by experienced terrorists. Fox said investigators based that speculation on a gut feeling that grew out of long experience. FBI Director William Sessions told the House panel that there's no reason to fear that the bombing is the beginning of a coming wave of terrorism. Israel, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, and the Palestinians are about to receive invitations to attend the next round of Middle East peace talks in Washington. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
The U.S. and Russian governments, co-sponsors of the peace talks, have already said they intend to invite Arab and Israeli delegations to resume the negotiations in April. It now appears that April 20th has been set as the precise date, as first reported by the Associated Press. There's been no official announcement. It's not certain that the Arab delegations will agree to attend. Palestinian leaders continue to say they'll boycott the talks until Israel repatriates 400 Palestinian deportees now in South Lebanon. Other Arab leaders have been reluctant to break ranks with the Palestinians. On the other hand, Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan are eager to resume the peace process, and the Clinton administration obviously believes the odds are good that at least some of the Arab delegations will attend. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Stock prices set another record today on Wall Street, bumped higher by the momentum from yesterday's 64-point surge. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 3 points to close at a record 3,472. Advances led declines by a margin of 5-4 in heavy trading of 290 million shares. This is NPR. The chairman of the House Budget Committee said today that his panel is ready to support $63 billion in cuts over and above those already proposed by President Clinton. Martin Szabo said there's broad support among Democrats for additional cuts over the next 5 years. The Minnesota Democrat has scheduled a vote on the cuts for tomorrow. The Italian government has backed down on its controversial proposals to try to bring the present corruption investigation to a swift end. And the head of the huge Italian state energy group has been arrested in connection with the investigation. Francis Kennedy reports from Rome.
The cabinet has abandoned its plan to cancel prison sentences for those breaking the laws on party funding, following criticism by the president and the judges and outrage from the public. Other proposals to speed up the legal process and reduce penalties for those who pay back the bribe money are to be discussed in Parliament. Meanwhile, Gabriele Cagliari, the head of the state energy conglomerate, has been arrested. He's charged in connection with a multi-million dollar bribe on contracts for an industrial plant. The huge energy sector has been one of the most lucrative sources of funding for political parties. A parliamentary committee today recommended that the immunity from prosecution be lifted for the former Prime Minister Bettino Craxi, and Parliament is expected to formally approve the decision within the week. For National Public Radio, I'm Frances Kennedy in Rome.
More tourists began to venture abroad again last year, helping the industry recover from a period of stagnation in 1991 when the Persian Gulf War kept some potential travelers at home. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development said that tourism rose by 3.7% last year in its member countries, which include most of the world's richest nations. The recovery came in spite of the continuing economic recession. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you want to know what it takes to get a TV series on the air, my guest Tom Fontana is a good person to ask. He's an executive producer and writer for the new NBC series Homicide, about homicide detectives. It's been on for 6 weeks, and Fontana is already at work on a pilot for a new ABC series scheduled for the fall about firefighters. Fontana has also been a producer and head writer for St. Elsewhere, and executive producer and writer on Tattingers and Home Fires. Homicide is as much about character as it is about crime-solving. In this scene, a rookie homicide detective is in the car with his more experienced and cynical partner.
You know something? You said to me something the other day. You said that I would never be a homicide detective because I don't have a killer's mind.
Mm-hmm.
So do you?
Do I what? Do I have a killer's mind?
Yeah.
Do me a favor. Take a look outside there. Tell me what you see.
Now, let's see. I see people hanging out on their stoops. I see some trees. I see a grocery store.
Okay, I look out here and I see the same stuff, but all this stuff has my name written on it, just like the criminal. I see unlocked cars. I see snatchable pocketbooks. I see windows open just a crack.
What does this have to do with murder? That's funny.
Don't you get that?
What?
That's my point exactly, Davis.
Homicide has a couple of things in common with St. Elsewhere. Each episode tells several interconnecting stories. Most episodes end with unresolved stories that continue into the next week. Fontana told me it's getting difficult to sell these kinds of shows.
In foreign markets, they just want a lot of single-episode shows of a series so that they can show them in any order. And if they have to do them, chronologically, the foreign distributors get ticked off about that. So in that regard, that's the one reason why I think you see a decline in that kind of storytelling in television. To me, again, that's what's attractive to me about television, because it's like writing a novel. Every week you get to do another chapter, and it's not like reinventing everything, every week.
What were some of the lessons you learned from St. Elsewhere about what you have to do to make that continuing storyline work?
Well, I think that one of the mistakes we made early on in St. Elsewhere was not allowing the audience to get to care about the patient, so that when we killed the patient, which we always did, we wanted the audience to have some kind of an emotional response to that. The way we did that was by tying it into the doctor or nurse who was taking care of that particular patient. On Homicide, it's a little different because the focus of the story is a person who's been murdered. So you don't really have a lot of communication between the detective and the murder victim. So what we've tried to do with Homicide is to deal with it much more on the relationships between the two detectives working on the case, and kind of the horror of what they experience on a day-to-day basis. I mean, these are guys who every day they go to work, their job is to look at a dead body, something that most of us do maybe once in a lifetime and are repulsed by it then.
You know, in soap operas, the action takes place really, really slowly, so I'll tell you, if you miss an episode, you probably haven't missed anything. How much action do you figure can happen in each episode and still have the audience keep up?
Well, we've never concerned ourselves, in the shows that I've worked on, we've never concerned ourselves with you know, keeping the audience up. Our feeling is that if you do a show that there's a continuing story, you always put in one self-contained story so that hopefully the audience would be satisfied if they've never seen the show before.
Mm-hmm.
There's one story that has a beginning, middle, and an end within the hour that they would, they'd be satisfied by.
Now, there's an episode where you kind of didn't do that. There was an episode, this was last week, actually, in which the whole the whole program was one long interrogation. It was two cops on a case where, and this case has been on since virtually the beginning of the series, an 11-year-old is butchered by somebody. And this is the person who one of the cops really believes did it. And after this virtually hour-long interrogation, it's still ambiguous.
Right. That's the kind of writing I do. It's funny that because a couple reviews came out, one in the New York Times and one in the L.A. Times, that talked about that particular episode. I wrote that episode.
I know.
And it talked about that particular show's ambiguity and enigmatic nature. And I kind of read them and went, oh, my God, I'm enigmatic. I'm ambiguous. I never knew that. So
when you're doing a series, you write a lot of the episodes.
Yeah. What I do is I tend to conceive the story for the episode and then hire a freelance writer or a story editor who's on staff. They then do like two drafts of the script. And then it comes back to me. Well, each draft comes back to me for notes, and then the draft comes back to me for final, for a polish. And that's pretty much, you know, I have the final say. Then I get notes from the network and the censors and the studio and, you know, everybody's and their grandmother. But pretty much, you know, I do the final script that goes out of the set. And if the actors have any changes, they come and deal with me about them.
Now, how do you feel about this idea of conceiving of the story and giving it out to a freelancer to actually write?
Well, it's actually a lot better for me than it is for the freelancer because I conceive it and because I get it at the end, I can make sure that the story I wanted to tell gets told. I think it's a little frustrating to be a freelance writer in television because you have no power whatsoever. The only reason I'm a producer is because I learned very quickly that in Hollywood, if you don't produce, if you're a writer and you don't produce, you're never going to see what you've written get on the screen. I always try to keep as much as I possibly can of the freelance writer stuff, but a lot of times they either just don't get it or they, you know, it's just not what I had intended and I haven't been able to convey to them properly what I was looking for.
I know you used to be a playwright. Does the playwright within you say, this is no way to write?
No, actually, I was a terrible playwright and a particularly unsuccessful playwright. So I've gotten more off my chest writing for television, and more people have seen it than, you know, I used to play to houses of six. And now, 30 million people or 10 million people will see the show. And that's pretty juicy for a writer to know that that many people are at least going to, you know, on their way to the kitchen to get something, they'll be watching what you're doing.
The opening episode of Homicide was on just a few weeks ago, right after the Super Bowl, right?
Right.
Good placement. 43
million people yeah, saw it.
Not bad. What are some of the burdens that an opening episode of a series has to carry?
Well, you know, it's very tough to write the first episode because what you have to do is you have to introduce, in terms of an ensemble show, it's difficult. Not all pilots are difficult, but an ensemble show where you have 10 to 12 different characters, introducing those characters, defining those characters in a very short amount of time is very difficult. Then the added burden is, you know, audience to like the 10 or 12 characters that you've introduced, so that because episodic television is about seeing friends, you know, every week you say, oh, let's go see what those knuckleheads at Cheers are doing, and so you want the audience to not necessarily identify so much as appreciate the characters on your show. So that's difficult because you only got 47 minutes or something like that. Then what you want to do is to try to come up with a story or stories, in the particular case of Homicide, that will indicate the kind of stories that you're going to tell on a week-to-week basis. Now, in the Homicide, the first episode of Homicide, we didn't really emphasize the story. And it wasn't really till the second episode that we really, really started to say, okay, well, here's the A, B, C, D side of the show. You know, here's a little journey that you're going to take each week with these people. One of the reasons we did that in the first episode is, again, because we wanted to say to the audience, whatever your expectation is of a cop show, you ain't going to get it here. And as dangerous as that is, because, you know, most people want to see things they're familiar with, we thought it was important to say that to the audience, to not lie to the audience and say, well, you're going to get to see them arrest somebody every week and it's going to be, you know, like a typical cop show.
So what were some of the expectations that you felt you had to dash early on?
Well, I think that, for example, the show, the emphasis on the show is not on solving the murders. The emphasis is on the relationship between the partners. And so you might spend, whereas in a regular show, you'd spend, you know, 45 pages dealing with the murder and 10 pages dealing with the kind of buddy side of it, you know, the joking and the, oh, you know, jump in the car and all that stuff. We do the complete opposite. Most of it is about people kind of living their lives, and every once in a while they step over a dead body. The other thing is that we're not doing any car chases. We're not doing any gun shootouts, because most homicide detectives get there after the murder. You know, they're not a part of the action the way a uniform cop would be. And theirs is a much more intellectual kind of job than any other policeman. They're there doing research and investigation, and so the rhythm of their particular job is very different from anything. You know, most homicide shows, you see the cops and they're running and they're chasing and they're facing the bad guy and all that stuff. And it in real life it just doesn't happen that way. And because we were coming off of David Simon's book, and because we felt we had an obligation to the Baltimore Homicide Squad to depict them in an honest way, we kind of abandoned all that television storytelling.
My guest is Tom Fontana, an executive producer of the TV series Homicide, and he was a producer and the head writer for St. Elsewhere. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Tom Fontana is my guest. You said that you get notes from the censors, from the networks, from the studio. What kind of notes do people give you when they're critiquing a script or an episode?
Well, the censors' notes are always very difficult to take because they, for example, on one show, we had this sequence where one of the detectives was telling a Polish joke, and one of the other detectives was saying, well, why does it have to be Polish? And there was a discussion about between a couple of the detectives about why a Polish joke is a Polish joke as opposed to a Belgian joke, right? Now, I'm besides being Italian-American, I'm Polish-American, and I didn't find the sequence particularly offensive as a Polish-American because it was about exactly that. Why do people tell Polish jokes? It makes no difference. Well, the censors, you would have thought we had, taken Lech Walesa and like put paint all over him or something. I mean, the reaction was, oh, you can't make fun of Polish people. No, we're not making fun of Polish people. We're making fun of people who make Polish jokes. No, you can't do that. Anyway, you know, you fight and fight and fight. And part of it is you put stuff in and then depending on how you're feeling that particular week, you know, you either fight for it or you say, forget it. I'll just cut it out. That week we fought for it. So it stayed in. And, you know, the notes from the network tend to be, oh, why can't they all hug each other? And, you know, wouldn't it be nice if they actually captured somebody or somebody, you know, said, I'll never do that again. You know, they always want the easiest kind of comforting resolution because they have no, I'm amazed I think that the network has virtually no faith in the intelligence or the sense of humor of the American public. I think they think America is just filled with completely stupid people who don't get anything, you know. And this is from, you know, guys, you know, middle-aged white guys who live in the Pacific Palisades, who know no more about the general American public than, you know, than George Bush did.
Well, when you're starting to write or conceive of a series, are you always second-guessing what are the network executives going to want? What will the censor say?
Well, you try not to let that influence you too much. I mean, with St. Elsewhere, the hilarious thing was they constantly wanted to turn it into Young Dr. Kildare. And we did everything we could to resist that because it's boring. It would be boring to write that every week.
What did you get the most grief for from the censors on that?
On St. Elsewhere?
Yeah.
We did a story about testicular cancer, and we weren't allowed to say, we actually got permission to say the word testicle, which was a huge breakthrough for them. We were not allowed to say the word balls, and it was about a bunch of college students, one college student in particular who had testicular cancer. And so it was kind of odd, these guys, you know, a bunch of college guys sitting around talking about testicles. But at least we got to say the word testicle. But we got, what was incredible about it is they didn't want us to do the story at all. Did not want us to do the story. When they read it, they were freaked out, the censors. They said, you cannot cut off a guy's ball on national television. It's just, you can't do it. So we said, well, that's interesting, because last week we cut off a woman's breast and you didn't even raise an eyebrow about that. And that kind of made that problem go away. I mean, they suddenly went, you know, because we were going to go to the press with that. We were going to say, hey, oh, you know, it's okay to, like, do a mastectomy, but it's not to you know, cut off a guy's ball on television. This is ridiculous. It's a double standard. And but the fight for what words you could use to say testicle was hilarious.
Now, you were going to go to the press if they didn't let you do that. That's a tough choice to make, isn't it? Because if you alienate the network too much, that's going to be a big problem for you.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, sometimes when, you know, it's one of these things where you know, they suck it in and you suck it in, and then eventually you, like, say, I'm pissy now. I'm in the mood for a fight. And what they do is they'll tend to back down, and then they'll kind of say, well, you're going to see. We're going to get letters. Oh, it's going to be terrible, blah, blah, blah. And I guess for as often as they get letters, they don't get letters. I mean, what was the ironic part about the whole testicular cancer story was that the letters we got were from young guys who said they never knew about testicular cancer. They didn't know you could do a self-examination. They didn't know that they were particularly a risk group, and that they did the self-exam, found out that they had a lump, went to the doctor, and were alive because they had been watching St. Elsewhere. So, you know, those are the kind of letters you should just kind of go, nyah, 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 to the network with, because when you can really, you know, do something like that. I mean, we never did, well, I shouldn't say that. We often did things that we did just to piss them off. But a lot of times we were trying to be as responsible as we could possibly be. You know, we did a thing about a breast self-examination, and because one of our characters had breast cancer, and they wouldn't let us, oddly enough, they wouldn't let us show her do a self-exam, but they would let us show on a monitor the American Cancer Society's breast self-examination. So we had to do it like a session where a bunch of women were being instructed about, but you, a woman couldn't actually, I mean, we're still seeing a nipple on television, but because it was on a monitor, they thought that was okay somehow, you know. It's that kind of thing that makes you crazy, because it all seems kind of arbitrary and ultimately it gets kind of debilitating.
Now, I want to ask you, the interrogation episode that you wrote?
For a homicide,
yeah. For homicide. Did you sit in on interrogations before writing that?
No, what I did was, some of it is from David's book,
mm-hmm.
and some of it is from transcripts of interrogations that I read.
Mm-hmm.
And from conversations that I had with the members of the Baltimore Homicide Squad. And then a part of it is just, you know, my imagination, because, again, it what where I was coming at it from was less this is a police interrogation, then this is three men in a room, each of whom wants something, you know? And what would you do, what would you say if you wanted something, you know? That's where I basically write from. It's from a character's need, you know, at that moment. That's what they say, because at that moment, this is what they need.
How is Homicide doing in the ratings?
What are the
measures you take seriously, and what are they saying to you?
Well, I not being very business smart, I don't really understand the numbers. I just know that that's the game. Those are the rules you play by. If you're going to work in television, it's the ratings that matter, because somebody decided that, you know, and I'm not about to be able to change that. So I accept the fact that if we get bad numbers, we have potentially going to be canceled. But on the other hand, you know, when they break it down in such a way that you, you know, they start to explain it to you, it sounds like physics to me. I mean, I don't get any of it. I know that the third episode we had was opposite the Michael Jackson interview, so we got killed that week. Then we were preempted for President Clinton's speech. And by that point already, you know, people are out of the habit of watching the show. The next week we were opposite the Grammys. The next week we were opposite the American Comedy Awards. I mean, this week I think we're opposite the end of the world or something. I mean, you know, so as I said, part of doing a TV series is getting the audience familiar,
yeah,
getting them to watch the show every week. And if they're so busy watching everything else that it's hard for them to get an affinity for the show.
So what do you do now to try to...
We basically go to NBC and beg and plead
for
and
what?
Whine
for
and
what?
Snivel. Well, if we had more episodes, we only made 9 episodes. And if we had more episodes, we would have tried to get them to move us to another time period.
Mm-hmm.
Because we don't have any more, and because we only have, I think, 4 more shows that are going to air, we didn't ask them to move us. What we did was say, well, are you really going to judge us by these numbers, and what can we do to convince you to pick up the show for a second season?
So what were your favorite shows when you were growing up? You were born in 51, so...
51, yes.
You grew up in the 50s and 60s.
Yes. My absolute all-time favorite show, and this is going to shock you, was Green Acres. And to this day, I
You're
love...
right, that shocks me. Well, I have this thing that I do not comprehend Green Acres.
Really?
Yeah. I don't get it. I just don't get it.
I just, with things like when they would like lift an egg up and it would say directed by so-and-so, when I was a kid, I just thought that was the funniest thing in the world. I don't know. It was existential television. You know what I mean? And today, when I watch it on Nick at Night or whatever, I like sit there and I go, God, this is just like I remember. But other than that, there, you know, I watched everything. I had the same bad taste at every, you know, kid growing up in the 50s. And then, you know, in the 60s, when I went to high school, I stopped watching television. And by the time I got to college, I guess I was watching Saturday Night Live. No, that was later. The Mary Tyler Moore Show, you know.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything on TV that really means something to you now, besides something professional?
You mean, is there like a show that I watch regularly?
Yeah.
Well, I still love Cheers. I have to say that. And, but I, God's honest truth, and this is terrible to say it, but I don't watch much television. I don't go to the movies, because I have this weird thing where, because I'm a writer, I spend so much time in fantasy that to then sit down and watch 2 hours of somebody else's fantasy, do you know what I mean? It's kind
right.
of, I'm bored. I'd rather be out in the streets hanging out and, you know, playing pool and, I don't know, talking to friends and kind of seeing what's really going on.
Tom Fontana is the executive producer of Homicide, which airs Wednesday nights on NBC. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, Make My Day. That line was made famous by Clint Eastwood and echoed by Ronald Reagan. Now it appears on the same page of Bartlett's quotations as Bruce Springsteen's much-quoted lyric, "Tramps like us, baby, we were born to run." So you don't have to be highbrow to be quoted in Bartlett's. We'll find out why from Justin Kaplan, who edited the latest edition. And book critic John Leonard reviews James Miller's new biography of the French philosopher Michel Foucault. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. FBI Director William Sessions and other law enforcement officials testified today on Capitol Hill about the bombing more than 1 week ago underneath the World Trade Center in New York City. NPR's Anthony Brooks reports that lawmakers wanted to know if this attack was the start of a new cycle of terrorism.
Sessions was unable to say much about the particulars of the ongoing investigation into last month's bombing in New York, which killed 5 people and injured 1,000. He did answer the question many people are asking: was this an isolated event, or should the country brace for more attacks of this kind?
The American public should always be vigilant, but this suspected act of terrorism should not be so viewed as an opening act of a coming wave of terror.
Sessions says over the past 10 years, the number of terrorist attacks in the U.S. has steadily declined thanks to the government's anti-terrorist strategy. Nevertheless, some members of Congress are proposing legislation that would toughen penalties for terrorist acts, including imposition of the death penalty when they result in a loss of life. This is Anthony Brooks in Washington.
In Los Angeles, Rodney King testified today for the first time about his beating 2 years ago by L.A. police officers. Testifying this afternoon in a federal civil rights trial of police officers, King said on the day after his beating he was in lots of pain and felt horrible. King said that he was very confused, and while he knew that he had been beaten by police, he wasn't sure about what happened. King conceded that on that night 2 years ago, he had been drinking while watching television, and before he was pulled over, he was speeding. He denied taking PCP or smoking marijuana. On Capitol Hill today, the top trade official in the Clinton administration testified concerning trade issues. NPR's John Itzde reports.
Mickey Cantor, the U.S. trade representative, told a Senate hearing that the Clinton administration would continue to pursue open markets and expanded trade while insisting that the markets of other nations be open to our products. Cantor said the free trade agreement between the United States, Mexico, and Canada would not be sent to the Congress until side agreements on the environment, worker safety, and import surges are completed. Talks on those issues begin next week. He told senators the treaty itself would not be reopened despite requests for changes from a number of industries. Cantor also said he believed the GATT World Trade talks would be completed, but he suggested negotiators weren't as close to a deal as the Bush administration claimed in January. Cantor said the Japanese must get more involved if those talks are to reach a successful conclusion. I'm John Itzde in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 3 points to close at a new record high of 3,472.12 on volume of more than 290 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 5-4. This is NPR News. FBI officials say the leader of a religious cult near Waco, Texas, is moving along 2 tracks, one peaceful, one not. For 10 days now, there's been a standoff between heavily armed cult members and law enforcement personnel. FBI agent Bob Rick says his agency is ready for whatever force David Koresh might use. Early on in the siege, after 4 federal agents were killed in an attempted raid, the FBI said it was not planning to storm the cult's compound, and that statement was made again today. Britain and the PLO have resumed direct contact. Today, a PLO delegation met with high-ranking officials of Britain's Foreign Office. In London, NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports.
Today's meeting was the first high-level discussion between the two sides since Britain broke off contacts with the PLO during the Gulf War 2 years ago. British Foreign Office Minister Douglas Hogg said he had told the Palestinian delegation of Britain's desire to get the bilateral Mideast peace talks going again. The talks have been suspended since last December, when Israel deported 415 Palestinians accused of belonging to hostile Muslim extremist groups. Today's meeting angered Israeli officials, who said Britain's contact with the PLO could delay the restart of the talks. Israel's Deputy Foreign Minister, Yossi Beilin, is expected in London on Thursday to meet with Douglas Hogg. Hogg said he would be discussing the deportations with him. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
In Somalia, U.S. military officials say that troops are now in a state of heightened awareness in advance of a slated peace conference. New checkpoints have been set up to guard against demonstrators hoping to break up the peace conference. Last month, supporters of one of the nation's strongest warlords rioted for 2 days after an attack by a rival faction in the port city of Kismayu. In the capital, soldiers have been building new roadblocks. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. If you want to impress people with a perceptive quote, the place to turn is Bartlett's Familiar Quotations. The first volume was published in 1855 by John Bartlett. The 16th edition was edited by my guest Justin Kaplan. Our interview was recorded last fall when the new Bartlett's was published. Kaplan is the author of biographies of Walt Whitman, Mark Twain, and Lincoln Steffens. The new Bartlett's has over a page of entries on the subject of war. You know the quote, "War is hell"? It comes from a military academy commencement address by General William Sherman in 1879. He said, "War is at best barbarism. Its glory is all moonshine. It is only those who have neither fired a shot nor heard the shrieks and groans of the wounded who cry aloud for blood, more vengeance, more desolation. War is hell." Justin Kaplan has also included contemporary quotes about war. This one is from the Francis Ford Coppola film Apocalypse Now. The line was spoken by Robert Duvall.
"I love the smell of napalm in the morning. It smells like victory." There's another quotation from a brilliant book by Michael Herr called Dispatches. And I'll read you two quotations from it. "I think Vietnam was what we had instead of happy childhoods," is one of them. And then the other quotation deals with, I think, the organic connection between the Vietnam War and rock lyrics. And that's one reason you'll find so many rock lyrics in the current edition. This, again, is from Herr's Dispatches. "Out on the street, I couldn't tell the Vietnam veterans from the rock and roll veterans. The 60s had made so many casualties. Its war and its music had run power off the same circuit for so long, they didn't even have to fuse."
So you told us why you chose the Michael Herr quote. What about the quote about napalm in the morning from Apocalypse Now?
Well, I thought that was Apocalypse Now certainly is a classic movie about the Vietnam era, but to go beyond that, I gave a fair amount of thought to where people get their quotations from these days. They don't, this is an obvious statement, that they don't quote from Shakespeare and the Bible or Virgil as much as they used to. In fact, they don't quote from them at all. If you listen to the conversation of rather well-educated people, for example, meeting at a party, you'll find that the common ground that they immediately find is the movies. And the movies supply the so-called lingua franca of our era. The Italians, I'm told, think of the movies as the tenth muse and would not be surprised if the other nine muses had to roll over to make room for it. I'm thinking, of course, of the Chuck Berry lyric, "Roll over Beethoven and tell Tchaikovsky the news." I hope it's not true, but the movies are important, and the movies are where most quotations these days come from.
Well, public radio listeners will be pleased to know that you quote Garrison Keillor.
Well, I thought he belonged here. I thought he was absolutely essential.
You want to read the quote?
Well, I put in two quotations from Garrison Keillor. I think both of them are firmly rooted in the American memory by now. "That's the news from Lake Wobegon, where all the women are strong, the men are good-looking, and all the children are above average." And, of course, the second is a description of the town. "It's the little town that time forgot, that the decades cannot improve."
I wonder if Garrison knows he's in here. Do you let people know that they're going to be in Bartlett's?
No, I let them find out the hard way simply by looking at the book. They do not get a letter of notification, no.
Well, Zippy the Pinhead fans will be pleased to know that you've quoted him as saying, "Are we having fun yet?" And Zippy the Pinhead is the cartoon creation of Bill Griffith.
I'm glad we put that in, and I know that Bill Griffith had a fair amount of trouble establishing his proprietary right in that line, because it had been attributed to, I think, various television shows or a movie. But I'm glad to say that justice has been done, finally.
James Brown has made it into Bartlett's. Say
yes.
It loud, I'm black and I'm proud.
Right.
Your choice?
I believe so, yes.
Now, there's a quote that our listeners will probably remember. "Love means not ever having to say you're sorry." That's Eric Siegel from the movie Love Story. How did you feel about having that in Bartlett's quotation? It's really, I think, one of the kind of cornier quotes, or it's certainly become that.
Well, it's certainly one of the stupidest single lines of dialogue ever written. But it is so stupid and so meaningless that, again, it became burned in the American memory. And I believe that there's a later movie in which Ryan O'Neill, who played in the original Love Story, another movie in which Ryan O'Neill quotes the line and says something like, "I think that's the stupidest thing I ever heard." Well, regardless of its stupidity, that's the one thing from Love Story that you can count on people remembering.
But you didn't feel the need to put in parentheses, "I, the editor of this edition, do not really believe this is a profound thought."
I do not indicate when I put a clothespin over my nose.
Now, if you were putting this together today, you know, if you were still editing the book, would James Stockdale's now famous quote of "Who am I? Why am I here?" be included?
I'm not sure. Again, it's a very close call between what you think will have lasting power, and I don't mean timelessness. I mean something that will last in the memory for 10 years. I somehow have the feeling that Stockdale's rather pathetic and appealing line, I have the feeling that won't last. That he was very much of a passing phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas certain obvious Bushisms and Reaganisms are burned in our memory.
Like what?
Well, 1,000 points of light. That phrase has been in existence since, it's written by
Peggy Noonan,
a brilliant speechwriter. That's been in existence since 1988, when Bush first uttered these words at the Republican National Convention in New Orleans. Well, by now, 1,000 points of light must have figured in at least 1,000 jokes, cartoons, quips, and so on. There was a Herb Block cartoon right after the convention which showed you two people sitting in a saloon, and one of them says, "Well, I guess he meant 1,000 pints of light beer." And then shortly after that, I remember that there was a full-page ad in the New York Times for a dress that Macy's was promoting. It was a sequin dress, and it said 1,000 points of light. And I think the comment on that enduring but meaningless phrase that I like most, and I forget who said it, the comment was that Bush unfortunately forgot to tell you that batteries were not included. I wish I could claim authorship of that quip. It's not mine.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Justin Kaplan, and he's edited a new edition of Bartlett's Quotations. We'll talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Justin Kaplan is my guest, and we're talking about Bartlett's Quotations. He edited the new edition, which has just been published. I sometimes think of Bartlett's Quotations as being a book for cheaters, for people who have a luncheon address or a speech they have to give, and they want to say something profound, so they'll quickly find a quote in Bartlett's. And then they'll say it as if these words have guided them all their life, you know, and that the person who they're quoting has been a lifelong influence upon them. And I wonder how you feel about that.
Well, that's one use for it. People do use quotations to to dress up their own thoughts to impress people. And Bartlett's, as a reference book, is an invaluable tool in doing that. But it, I think it goes way beyond that. I like to think of it not simply as a reference book, but as a reading book. It's a rather unique anthology. It is, after all, not arranged like a dictionary alphabetically, which is the way most quotation books are arranged. It's arranged chronologically, which seems at first glance rather odd and maybe a little unwieldy as far as using the book is concerned. But what that gives the book is a very special character of a reading book. You can start at the beginning with ancient Egypt, if you choose, and you work your way up to the present time. And you may have the feeling that you're hearing people of a certain era. You're getting the flavor of a certain era as time moves along.
Well, let me just underscore what you're saying by quoting Winston Churchill. And there's actually a quote about Bartlett's quotations within Bartlett's quotations. It's by Winston Churchill.
That, that's
like
a, this. A little self-promotion.
Yes. Yeah. But you quote Churchill as saying, "It is a good thing for an uneducated man to read books of quotations. Bartlett's Familiar Quotations is an admirable work, and I studied it intently. The quotations, when engraved upon the memory, give you good thoughts. They also make you anxious to read the authors and look for more."
Well, I'm not sure that shouldn't have been on the jacket of this book instead of in the book itself.
A little blurb.
It's an internal blurb.
Have you had to speak at luncheons or anything in the past few years while you've been editing this book? And did you find yourself using quotes that you had been choosing to include in here? You know, did you become quite the quoter?
Well, I've always been a quoter. I think I'm trying to cure myself of that habit.
How have you used quotes?
I think very largely to illustrate the meaning of words or the development of ideas. You know, I don't use them to lend authority to what I say. That's one use of quotations. It doesn't happen to be mine. I could go on. I've given, obviously, a certain amount of thought to why and how people use quotations. And I think one way they use them is as passwords, as the equivalent of secret handshakes. If you make a reference that either a direct quotation or an allusion that the other person understands, you've established a certain bond. You can say, "I understand you. We speak the same language."
You're a biographer in addition editing Bartlett's. And two of the people who you've written biographies of are two of the most quoted Americans, Mark Twain and Walt Whitman. Did you often see them quoted out of context or, you know, quoted, you know, with the wrong interpretation?
Well, Mark Twain is always being either overquoted or misquoted. And I did a certain amount of correction in the Mark Twain section here. I redid all of the Mark Twain quotations because I thought the Mark Twain that we value these days is much more Mark Twain, the satirist, and Mark Twain, the vernacular artist. And so I tended to reduce the amount of, you know, pure sentiment which some people associate with Mark Twain. In the way of restoring balance, I've restored to Mark Twain the famous quip, "Everyone grumbles about the weather, but no one does anything about it." My predecessors had attributed that to a friend of Mark Twain's named Charles Dudley Warner. I'm pretty sure that it belongs to Mark Twain. On the other hand, there's another quip that people have associated with Mark Twain, and that is, "Wagner's music is better than it sounds." But if you look at Mark Twain's autobiography, he directly attributes that to a fellow humorist named Bill Nye. And that's where the credit goes this time.
So it's time for us to wrap up. Should I ask you something silly, like, can you leave us with an inspiring quote? You must get asked this all the time. It must be really frustrating.
I suppose if I had to come up with an inspiring quote, it would be of a distinctly vernacular sort. It's a quotation attributed to Yogi Berra, and I have to underline the word attributed. I like it very much. It runs, "When you come to a fork in the road, take it." make of that what you want.
That's great. Justin Kaplan, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Justin Kaplan edited the new edition of Bartlett's Familiar Quotations. This is Fresh Air. Janet Reno started her confirmation hearings today for the position of Attorney General. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, how will you be covering that on All Things Considered?
We have that hearing personed, womaned by Nina Totenberg, Terry, and she will be reporting on this last job still open in the cabinet. There's quite a bit of activity at the Capitol today. There are also hearings on terrorism, which we're covering. The president is meeting with Mitterrand to discuss the Airbus and aid to Yugoslavia. And Wendy Kaufman will be standing by at the LAPD trial. Rodney King is expected to testify today, and so we'll be watching that as well.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The French philosopher Michel Foucault was controversial for the ideas he expressed in his books, Madness and Civilization, The History of Sexuality, The Use of Pleasure, and The Care of Self. He was also controversial for the way he lived his life. He is the subject of a new biography by James Miller called The Passion of Michel Foucault. Foucault died in 1984 at the age of 57. In the last few years of his life, he divided his time between Paris and Northern California. Critic John Leonard has a review of the new biography.
It's not Michel Foucault's fault that students at Berkeley in the early 1980s misconstrued him as a sort of metaphysical eraser head. But the inability of the famously chic French philosopher to stay away from San Francisco's leather bars and bathhouses, even though he may have known he was dying of AIDS, does raise lurid questions about ethics and denial and philosophy and French intellectuals. James Miller, who's also written books on Rousseau and the American student left, seeks answers to these questions in a close reading of Foucault's secret life and the evasive texts in which he hid himself like a minotaur in a labyrinth. What Miller finds is a scary love affair with death. According to Miller, all of Foucault is an allegory of endless domination, from the hangman torturing the murderer to the doctor locking up the deviant. His books argue that every institution, asylums, prisons, armies, schools, professions, is in business to beat down the individual, to neutralize dangerous states, to create docile bodies and obedient souls. How to escape these numbing codes of discipline? By deconstructing the body as if it were a text, by seeking what Foucault called the limit experience in art, dreams, drugs, politics, madness, and sadomasochistic eroticism. Through such limit experiences, he would locate our demonic aspect, secret being, singular fate. Through passion and delirium, erotic transgression, secret self-ravishment, and absolute sacrifice, he would achieve what he called an insurrection of unsubjugated knowledges, Heidegger's notorious ontology of unthought, rapture, and perhaps transcendence, but maybe also cruelty and death. The mentors who brought Foucault to this pass included Nietzsche, of course, and Heidegger, and Kant, Stoics like Seneca and cynics like Diogenes, but also writers like the Marquis de Sade and painters like Goya and composers like Stockhausen, to whom he listened while tripping out on LSD. With such cohorts, no wonder he'd insist that modern doctrines of moral responsibility are a form of terrorism. They get in the way of transcendence. Finally, there is Michel himself, who hated his surgeon father, who attempted suicide in grade school with a razor and a rope, who quit analysis when his therapist went on vacation, who trafficked with structuralists, Maoists, and hashish, whose clever mind was blown in California, in Death Valley by acid, in San Francisco by handcuffs, blindfolds, and riding crops, by hot wax dripped on alligator clips, a dungeon, and a crucifix, with his shaved head, wire-rimmed glasses, and leather chaps, the bald savant, says Miller, as postmodernist sphinx. Troubled as he is by what he tells us, Miller is also almost painfully sympathetic. I am less so. Never mind the damage Foucault might have done in San Francisco. Consider a larger suicidal trendiness. As anxious as all these post-war French intellectuals were to get rid of their imaginary father, Jean-Paul Sartre, they killed off socialism and humanism and the Enlightenment in the process. They were also in their theaters of cruelty, busy strangling their wives, dying of alcoholism and drugs, and going crazy. It was as if they murdered reason. And why are we surprised? After all, Heidegger's ontology of unthought led him to the limit experience of the Nazis, to Hitler's hot wax carnival of death.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed The Passion of Michel Foucault by James Miller. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Penny Nelson. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Philip Roth has a new novel. It's his second book that's alluded to a recent physical ordeal and severe depression. On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk about what really happened and about some of the themes that have recurred in his fiction since Goodbye Columbus and Portnoy's Complaint. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.